All right, good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started. This is the session on the Trademark Clearinghouse implementation. This is an update on all of the project work that's been going on towards startup of the Trademark Clearinghouse. My name is Karen Lentz from ICANN. I'm joined up here by colleagues from the team. To the far right is Don Fancher from Deloitte, Jan Janssen from CHIP, Jan Korstens from Deloitte, Vicky Follens from Deloitte, and to the left here is Bill Yang from JAS Advisors. So the objective of this session is to go through and show you a lot of the work that's been taking place on developing the clearinghouse. I know some people may have been following this for a while. If you're new to this, it's kind of an exciting time because there's a lot happening. So we want to take you through that today. This is how we expect to spend the time during this session. I'll give a little bit of an update on the work that's been achieved so far on this project and the work that's ongoing. There are a number of team members from Deloitte who will walk you through some of the clearinghouse processes and the system that's been built for submitting trademark data into the clearinghouse. And you'll get to see quite a bit of that. And then we have 30 minutes at the end for questions and comments from the group. So the Trademark Clearinghouse was proposed to be a repository for trademark data. There was an interest in having data to rely on that had been verified and that parties knew that they could rely on. And so the Clearinghouse was proposed to be essentially a database for rights information that would be used to support rights protection mechanisms in new GTLDs. And one of the expected outcomes of that is that there would be a central source for that data that rights holders would not need to go many places and register and have their rights validated to register in each new TLD, that there would be efficiencies gained by having one place to do that. The clearinghouse has a few core functions. The first is to accept the submissions of trademark data that rights holders provide to verify that those rights exist. They will also maintain the database of all of that information and then use it working with registries to support the Sunrise and the trademark claims services. The Sunrise is an opportunity pre-launch for eligible rights holders to register domain names before the TLD opens up generally to the public. And then the trademark claim service is designed to provide for, also during the startup phases, a notice mechanism. So if someone is trying to register a domain name, and it matches a record in the clearinghouse, that a notice would be provided to that registrant informing them of the rights that had been recorded in the clearinghouse and confirming that they do wish to proceed or don't. And then when a name is registered in that period as part of the claim service, the relevant rights holders who have data in the clearinghouse, who have matching records in the clearinghouse, would be notified of that domain name registration. This is been difficult to fit on a slide, but it's an attempt to show, depict the work that's taking place. So it was about a little over a year ago that the project really got started. One of the things, initial things that you see on the left there as coming into now, one was the Implementation Assistance Group, or IAG, which was a volunteer group of stakeholders that we asked for input and advice on how to implement the processes that were laid out in the guidebook. And then Once that advice had taken place, we developed a draft model covering several of those processes, and the community discussions have actually continued in various forms since that time. So that's ongoing. Also, a little over a year ago, released a request for information looking for providers to provide the clearinghouse services. We're happy to be working with Deloitte and IBM on this project, and since I guess Q2 of this year, we've been formed a team, created a project plan and design, and started to execute against that project plan. The purple arrows you see there have to do with the development of the trademark interface, the interface that's used for putting data into the clearinghouse. The development of that has been ongoing, and you'll see that there's quite a bit been done on that today. The bottom piece has to do with the registry interface, and I'll talk a little bit about that on the next slide. But if you see where we are in Q4 of this year, there's really a need to complete a set of requirements so that the development of those interfaces can begin and be tested. We have established a 90-day window minimum for the time that we want the clearinghouse to be available for rights holders to put names or put information in before any of the new GTLDs go live and are accepting registrations. So that's kind of the rule of thumb we're using in how to plan for time, is that we want to allow at least 90 days to do that. And then in terms of the registry interface, it's also keeping in mind the fact that there's a lot of work to be done on the registry and registrar systems to be able to incorporate these processes, which is why we want to reach some conclusions on these discussions that we've been having this week as soon as we reasonably can. So the discussions that have taken place this week in Toronto are around some work that's been done in the past couple of months. The first item that you see up there is the technical requirements for the Sunrise and claims processes. There, in terms of the Sunrise, there are a few different ways that could be achieved. You can use a code. You can use a file. There are various ways or mechanisms that can be used as indicators of Sunrise eligibility. So we've been discussing those options, and one of the questions and elements of that has been, who needs to have access to the data and at what point during the process. So that's been discussed this week. In terms of the trademark claims, this is a more complex system where information is used by many parties in the process. So there's been discussion around having a centralized or decentralized implementation of that in terms of how the data gets distributed and accessed. And again, questions of who needs the data and what parameters need to be around that for how that data is accessed and used. So we've had a session focusing on this on Monday of this week, and continuing yesterday in many of the stakeholder groups and constituencies. And, informally, we've continued to follow up on those discussions with stakeholders. And we're, I think, fairly confident that we can reach a resolution in the next couple weeks that we need to do. Also this week, the second two bullets on this slide relate to some materials that were published just prior to this meeting at the end of September, that we published for public comment. One being on how proof of use is verified. So that's an element that comes into play with the sunrise period. And we put out a memo on how we expect the clearinghouse to perform that process. And the other last bullet there is matching rules, which is a fairly detailed explanation of how the clearinghouse will apply the definition of identical match. That was something that was described in the applicant guidebook and agreed upon by in previous community discussions. So those are the activities that have been happening this week. I'm going to turn it over to Vicki Follens, who's going to take you through a lot of the work that Deloitte has been doing, and then we'll go to discussion. Thanks.
Thank you, Karen, and thank everybody here for attending the session. So today we'll talk about the Trademark Clearinghouse, some specific features, and how we have implemented the clearinghouse so far. The features that we want to discuss is which services, in first instance, the clearinghouse will provide, how to register with the clearinghouse, some items around the proof of use, the matching rules, dispute resolution process, what are the grounds of disputes, the customer support, and then show you some slides of where we stand today and how we have implemented these items. So the clearinghouse, which services will it provide to trademark holders, trademark agents? In first instance, Karen has already said that the clearinghouse will be a central database that stores and verifies trademark data. So what will the clearinghouse do? In first instance, we're going to verify the trademark data submitted to the clearinghouse. Once trademark data has been verified, a trademark holder will be able to opt for Sunrise services or trademark claim services. We will also provide the possibility to dispute a decision taken by the clearinghouse, and at all times, we will provide customer support to our agents and holders using the clearinghouse. There may be in time other services that the clearinghouse will provide, but we do not know that at this time, that will be discussed on a base-to-basis. Who will be able to register? What are the eligibility requirements? So in first instance, it's an agent acting on behalf of a trademark holder or a trademark holder that is the holder, meaning the owner, assignee, or licensee of a nationally or regionally registered trademark. What is a nationally or regionally registered trademark? Some examples are U.S. trademark, a European trademark, what will not be acceptable, are state marks, for example. A court-validated mark, some examples are the unregistered trademark, well-known and protected marks. What will also be accepted in the clearinghouse are marks protected by statute or treaty. These can be geographical indications, designations of origins, the names relating to the International Olympic Committee or the Red Cross. Could be other examples as well. We've just listed some examples. It's important to note that the statute or treaty must be enforced before June 2008. The applicant guidebook also states that other marks that constitute intellectual property will be able to be submitted to the clearinghouse. At this moment, we do not know what these other marks will be, as this is dependent of the registry policies. What will not be eligible is any mark, no matter which category of marks you'll fall in. The marks that start with a dot or contain a dot will not be acceptable. So meaning if I have a trademark A.B, it will not be accepted in the clearinghouse. Any registered trademark that was subject to successful invalidation, cancellation, or rectification proceedings. It's important that the trademark is registered at the moment of verification. And of course, due to the technical limitations of the domain name system, we cannot accept any IP rights that cannot be represented in the domain name system. Proof of use. So in order to be eligible to to receive Sunrise services, you need to provide proof of use. However, proof of use is only necessary when we're dealing with registered trademarks. What will the proof of use look like? It's going to be a completed declaration, and one sample of use needs to be uploaded in the clearinghouse. There are different samples that will be acceptable, such as labels, tags, containers from a product, advertising, or marketing materials. What will not be accepted are inclusions of a mark in a domain name, email messages, licenses to use a mark, or business cards. In principle, the declaration and the sample of use needs to be re-verified every 5 years. However, every trademark submission needs to be re-verified every year if you want to keep on receiving Sunrise notifications or trademark claims notifications. Does that mean that you need to provide us with a new sample of proof of use? In principle, no, unless, of course, your trademark record has changed and therefore your Sunrise, or your sample of use is no longer valid. Once the data has been verified, and in case of a registered trademark, your proof of use has been verified and is legible, a Sunrise code file will be generated. As you all are aware, we're not sure how this at this moment how it will be implemented, if it's going to be a code, a file, a key, or something else. Once that is generated, you will be able to use that to register a domain name during a Sunrise period, and you will also be able to receive Sunrise notifications when another holder or agent has used his Sunrise code and has a corresponding domain name and registered that within the TLD. Come to the other topic, the matching rules. So matching rules are applicable during both Sunrise services and trademark claim services. In principle, the domain name must be the identical match to the trademark. Meaning if your trademark is ICANN and you want to, for example, register in a TLD test, then you can receive the domain name ICANN.test. What will not be included or what is not allowed are plurals or parts of the mark. So if my trademark would be ICANX, I cannot have ICANXs, or I cannot delete X from my trademark. So it needs to be an exact match. However, we know that trademarks constitute of special characters that cannot be represented in the domain name system. So ICANN has provided us with the applicant guidebook states what will be implemented as an identical match when we're talking about special characters. The general rule is spaces, punctuations, or other characters, such as the plus or the exclamation mark, they can be omitted or they can be replaced by a hyphen. If there's a hyphen in your trademark, then you cannot omit or replace that. The hyphen will have to remain in your domain name. The examples that we show on the screen are ICANN space X, so you have the right to omit it, and then you have the right to receive the domain name ICANX, or you have the right to replace the space by a hyphen, so that'd be ICANN hyphen X. Now, there's an exception to that rule when we're talking about the special characters, the ampersand and the at sign. So you can still omit this, or you can still replace them by a hyphen, but you will also be able to translate those special characters in the official language or languages that correspond with the language of the jurisdiction in which your mark is protected. We'll show you later on how that will be implemented. Before we talk about the dispute process, we want to talk about the correction process. So once you have submitted trademark information to the clearinghouse and it goes through a verification process and the verification agents note that there is something wrong with the trademark record, stating that it might be incomplete or incorrect, then the trademark agents will actually provide feedback as to why a trademark record is incorrect or incomplete, and you will be able to correct that information. This is a correction process that we've put in place. It's free of charge, and it will be only be possible to do that one time. If after the correction process, you will be resubmitted to the clearinghouse, it will go through a re-verification process. If the record is still incorrect or invalid or does not meet the clearinghouse guidelines, then your trademark record will become invalid. At that moment in time, if you do not agree with the decision made by the clearinghouse, you can lodge a dispute. There are three different types of grounds for disputes. As I just mentioned, the first one, for a trademark holder or agent that does not agree with the verification that has been made, you can challenge that verification. You'll be able to challenge that verification within a period of 2 months' time after the trademark record has become invalid. Your dispute will be lodged through the interface of the clearinghouse. The dispute will actually be forwarded to an internal legal team that will look at your dispute, will see what you challenge, and at that time, the team will actually look at the information that was provided during the verification and will determine whether or not the verification agents have correctly followed the process and have provided with the correct verification. A third party can also challenge a decision made by the clearinghouse when he receives, for example, the trademark claims notification and he does not agree or thinks that the trademark record is invalid or something is wrong with the record. He will be also be able to file a dispute with the clearinghouse. Same process, it's an internal legal team separate from the verification agents that will actually look at that dispute. And any information that has become new will also be can be presented to the clearinghouse, and we will also look at new information and if we need to update a status of a particular trademark record based on new information, then that will happen as well. Through the whole process, we will be providing customer support. How have we divided this? In principle, there'll be a hotline available, meaning you can contact us by phone at all times when you have issues signing in with the clearinghouse. In all other cases, in all other questions, you will be requested to go through the clearinghouse website, where we will have a web ticketing tool. And this tool will be made available in English, so you can request all your services or questions in English, but you can also, in case you don't, if you want to be contacted by us in another language, you can request to be contacted in different languages. Now, how have we tried to implement all of this? We'll be able to show you in the next couple of slides. In first instance, in order to become a user of a clearinghouse, you need to register with the clearinghouse. On the screen, you'll see the homepage of the clearinghouse, where we have tried to make it as simple as possible to use, meaning there will only be three buttons that you can click on: the Add Mark button, the Register Dispute button, and the Request Support button. To become a first user, you need to click on the Add Mark, and the following interface will appear. This is general information that we need in order to make sure to verify that you are a user, and the information such as the name of the organization, the address, the email address where Sunrise notifications and trademark notifications will be sent to. You will also need to indicate whether you're acting as an agent or as a trademark holder. Now, as I already stated, an agent acts on behalf of a trademark holder. There are also some other differences in the interface, as from an agent will be working for multiple holders. A trademark holder will also be able to pay by credit card, while an agent will actually have a prepaid account or work with a prepaid account. It will also be possible to, next to providing contracting party, to provide details of who's actually using the application. So in our example, Deloitte would, for example, be the contracting party, while I would be entering the trademark information, so I would be the application user. Once you have entered all that information, if I go back to the slide. So once you have entered all of that information, you will actually be requested to accept our terms and conditions of the clearinghouse. If you agree to our terms and conditions, an email notification will be sent out to you, and we will provide you with your password to enter into the clearinghouse. Every time you enter into the clearinghouse, you just need to complete the green screen that you see on the big screen, signing in with your user's name and password, and then you get access to your trademark records. When you get access to your trademark records, you will actually see the following screen. It consists out of two tabs, marks, and domains and services. Here, the marks overview is empty because I've not submitted a trademark record at this time because I'm a new user. What do I need to do to add a mark to my list? You just click on Add Mark. When you click on Add Mark, the following interface will appear. And the first question that we ask is to provide us information on the mark type. So as discussed, we have three mark types: the registered trademark, the court-validated mark, and the treaty or statute, or marks protected under treaty or statute. It's important to select the correct type because we have actually adjusted all the fields according to the type. Because for a registered trademark, there's different information that needs to be provided to us in order to verify that information, while there's other information that needs to be provided when we're talking about court-validated marks. So depending on the selection you make, you'll receive different fields to complete. In the following example, we have selected the registered trademark, and the next question that you'll have to complete, or the next field you'll have to complete, is the name of the trademark holder. Now, for trademark agents that are dealing with multiple holders, once you have registered a trademark holder into the system, it will actually be saved, and you will be able to choose out of a drop-down list that trademark holder. If it's a new trademark holder you need to enter, you just need to click on New Holder, and the following fields that you see under Mark Holder will appear. All fields that are obligatory will be provided with an asterisk. If you do not complete them, then you will receive an error notification and you will not be able to process your trademark data. After you've completed the holder information, there are some other fields that need to be completed as well, such as the status of the holder. So is it the owner of the trademark? Is it the licensee of the trademark? Or is it the assignee of the trademark? The name of the mark. You'll see in my example, I've submitted A ampersand B as a trademark. The jurisdiction, so that's a drop-down list that you will be able to select the jurisdiction or the country in which your trademark or region that your trademark is protected. The registration number needs to be provided, the registration date will need to be provided, and the description of goods and services. When you click on description of goods and services, you will actually receive a list of all the descriptions where you can pick the description that corresponds with the marks or with the goods and services that your trademark is protected in. You will also have the possibility to upload attachments. So, for example, if I had put in here that the status of the owner was an assignee, then I could upload the assignment declaration into the clearinghouse. The clearinghouse will also generate automatically the domain names in accordance to the matching rules. So you see that the name of the mark that I put in here was A space ampersand space B, meaning that the spaces can be omitted and or replaced by a hyphen, and my ampersand can be omitted, replaced by a hyphen, or translated in the official language. As my jurisdiction is the United States, it's English that the ampersand will be translated in English. And you see on in the below corner the different possibilities of the domain name. Now, for this example, there's a limited list of possible corresponding domain names. However, if my trademark would have been much longer, it would have been could have been 20 to 30 to 40 to 50 different possibilities of what my domain name would be. When you submit your trademark, you will have the ability to choose 10 different domain names if you have more than 10 options. If you want to choose more than 10, you will also have the possibility to do so. However, there will be an extra charge when you choose or select more than 10 corresponding domain names. The system will automatically tell you when that will happen. Next to that, you will have the possibility to opt in or opt out for receiving a Sunrise code or file or key or receiving Sunrise notifications or trademark claims notifications. In the screen on the field, you'll see that trademark claim notification will be by default on. Sunrise code will by default not be on or not be selected. So if you select to opt in for Sunrise code and notifications, you will see that a field pops up requesting to provide proof of use. So I stated the proof of use, a completed declaration and a sample of proof of use needs to be uploaded. Once you have completed all of that, you just need to click on Add Mark, and then the verification process will start. How will you be able to manage your trademark records? Well, through the two different tabs, the Marks Overview and the Domain Services, there's different information that will be provided. So in the Marks Overview, you will see your list of your marks, your status of the different trademark records, and the mark holder. Now, we have different statuses that will be linked to a trademark record. The new status is when a trademark has been submitted and is under verification or has been submitted under the verification process. When your trademark data has been verified, you will receive the status verified. When trademark data is incomplete or incorrect, the trademark record will receive the status incorrect, meaning that you will be able to correct your information. When you have corrected your information, the status will change to corrected. In the event that your information is still incorrect or your trademark does not meet the clearinghouse eligibility requirements, then you will see that the record will change to an invalid status. And there's one final status that will be applicable is the deactivated status. So every trademark record needs to be renewed within a period of after 12 months' time. If you do not renew your trademark record will become deactivated. We will be providing notifications 60 days and 30 days prior to the expiration of a trademark record, so that will provide you with sufficient notification as to when your trademark record will expire. You will also be able to search on basis of different search criteria. You will also be able to sort your trademarks as you like. So, for example, if you want to sort on the name of the mark or the trademark holders, or if you just want to see all your new trademark records, you can click on New, and it will just show you all the new trademark records. Through the Domains and Services tab, you will be able to see all the marks listed, the corresponding U labels, the Sunrise code or Sunrise file will be able to be implemented here, and you will see that when the Sunrise notification or trademark claims notifications have been activated. As for the customer support and dispute resolution process, this is currently still under development. So we're still working on that, but if there's any questions or you want to look at the first information about the clearinghouse, we invite you to look at our website. It's trademark-clearinghouse.com. Or if you have any questions, you can always contact us by sending us an email at info@trademark-clearinghouse.com. Thank you.
So this was a little bit of an overview of where we stand with the current development. The session of today was to inform you. You should not expect that out of this session you already know how to use the clearinghouse. So we will definitely still organize training sessions in the upcoming months, and we will communicate about our training plan in the next few weeks. So rest assured, there will still be plenty of opportunity to learn how to use the clearinghouse. That was not the idea of today. We've also already had one-on-one sessions with organizations, and we will continue doing that so that we can be provided with feedback, as we are definitely committed to learn as much from the community as what their needs are, and to the extent possible take those into account.
Okay. Thank you, Vicky, and thank you, Jan, for taking us through all of that information. So we're actually finished with the slides ahead of schedule, so we have more time for questions and comments from the floor. So we've got two microphones in the room. We also have someone monitoring the remote participation for questions or comments. So let's start over here with Paul.
Hi, Paul McGrady from Winston & Strawn. First of all, I would like to say thank you for using the ICANN example as the mark. ICANN, of course, is the only mark on the globally do not sell list. The rest of us are operating under a different system. Just two quick questions. Could you explain the dot prohibition for trademarks that contain a period? I'll give you an example. Long live fun, financial services, namely stored value, card and electronic stored value card services by an outfit called Retail Royalty Company. I have no idea who they are. But they have a period at the end of fun, long live fun. Why would a mark like that be excluded? Would like to understand that a little bit better. And also a second question, and then I'll step away from the microphone. Have we really developed a system where every trademark has to be entered in manually instead of mapped by fields? And if we've actually done that, again, I don't know if the Trademark Paralegals Union International exists, but if they do, they want to thank you, because they'll be working nonstop for the next 12 months. So those are my two questions.
Especially with annual renewals.
Sorry. Hey, Paul, could I ask the second question? You said manually instead of what?
Instead of map, field to field. So all of the trademarks for most companies exist in 5 or 10 different kinds of databases put out by 5 or 10 different kinds of people who claim to have 5 or 10 better ways of doing things. But these are essentially map fields, right? And so those can be exported into essentially a fancy Excel spreadsheet, mapped to map and uploaded, and then we would have to upload PDF copies of declarations and proof of use, which would dramatically cut down the need to be putting these things in manually. The idea of a manual system where we put in trademark by trademark by trademark all around the globe, with some organizations having 20,000, 40,000 trademarks, is very 1985. And so I'm hoping that that's not really what we're seeing here. And so that is that the answer? Okay. Should I stay or should I go?
Okay, thanks, Paul. So on the first question regarding trademarks that have a dot in them, this was actually a requirement that's been included in the trademark clearinghouse section of the guidebook for a while. And that was something that was developed, I believe, with a concern in a couple different ways. One, that a domain name didn't necessarily serve the functions of a trademark, and that there were possible behaviors where people could use the trademark process to try to get eligibility or to establish some rights to get domain names that they wouldn't be able to otherwise. So that's something that was actually discussed a bit leading up to that requirement, and that's the requirement that we ended up with.
But the example that I gave was clearly not a domain name, right? And so if we've excluded an entire swath of brand owners and trademarks, probably tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands, I don't know, maybe millions around the globe, and if that's the reason, then I think that we need to go back and think about whether or not we're putting the dot, if we're focusing on the dot, or if we're focusing on that the trademark consists of a domain name, right? Because those are two different things, and I think that we can clearly see that, and so I would encourage us to think about that some more. And then the second question was the having to do with the mapping. Have we done mapping? Are we going to do mapping? Because I just...
Finish off on the first question. So that's right, that it's not necessarily, you can kind of distinguish from, looking at something with a dot in it and, is what's after the dot an existing TLD? Yes, you can answer that yes or no. But you don't know what, might become a TLD in the future.
I didn't mean to interrupt, but we have the universe right now of what might become a TLD in the future. And so if we're comparing the marks against the people who've currently applied to be registries, it's not open-ended. It's a closed system at this mm-hmm. point. So.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thank you.
And then on the, and I'll let Deloitte speak to this too, but I think that the clearinghouse was designed for a couple of types of users. Maybe I only have one trademark and I really care about it for that on an individual basis. Certainly it was anticipated that, people would, or users might have like high volume. So that's anticipated as well, but I'll let Jan speak to that.
Yeah, we didn't mention it explicitly because that's a part that is still under development, but there is definitely the idea to create an automated upload. I mean, Jan, perhaps you can give some more insight from a technical point of view, but that was definitely the idea.
Yeah, so the idea is to have an XML-based interface that's very structured, that's very well known in the community. So yeah, there will be an XML-based interface. The problems with that are that we are still trying to find a good solution for file upload. That's one of the issues we still have, so we're still talking to people to see how we should do that. And there's a few other hooks that need to be covered, little problems that need to be covered. So, but yes, there will be an XML interface to automate your systems.
Great, thank you.
Okay, next up, the speaker.
Hi, Steve Levy with Fairwinds Partners. I'd like to offer one suggestion and then ask one question. Following on Paul's comments about automation, has there been any? I would like to suggest that the instead of having an annual renewal fee, perhaps you allow the trademark owner to pay for registration for multiple years up through the current term of the trademark registration. That way we can avoid some more administrative time or at least allow a deposit account where you can have automatic renewals so that, again, you don't have to hire somebody to just dock it and track all of your renewals every year. We do a lot of that with trademark offices around the world, and to add one more on, it's just an extra task. And my question is, what mechanism will be in place to prevent fraudulent registrations? I can envision a situation where somebody may claim to be the agent for a brand owner and file a falsified claim and try to get all of those notifications. I know you have a dispute procedure, but is there anything up front, and what dispute standards will there be to fight this kind of fraud?
So, thank you. There will be, so when a trademark agent acts on behalf of a trademark holder, when he enters the trademark holder information, he will also need to enter an email address and a contact person of the trademark holder. And an email notification will be sent out to the trademark holder requesting them to confirm that the trademark agent can act on their behalf.
And how do you know that that's an actual person at the trademark holder?
There are different ways to verify that. So because we have the contact information of the trademark holder, it's easy to verify that information.
I'm just curious how you get that information, how you verify, because some trademark holders don't have their trademark in their email address, for example. They may use a holding company. How do you know that?
So in the event that it would be a different email, we would actually contact the person, the trademark holder.
And then when they reply saying, yes, I'm the trademark holder, is that considered adequate?
They'll have to provide some proof of that, I guess. Yeah.
All right, so this is still to be worked out, I guess.
Okay. There's a number of things that we're still looking into as to how far the requirements go. There will obviously also be some contractual protection that will be added on top of that.
Okay.
Do I think that we can prevent fraud for 100%? I don't know. I don't think so. But then in the end, that person would still be paying for somebody's trademark to be registered and given protection. You will still not get,
But behind the process, the automated process that you see here, there are individuals that are doing this review. It's not just a fully automated review. Mm. There will be teams, as we've described in Prague. There will be two teams of individuals that are performing this review, a first pass review and a second pass review. And so through that process as well, it's not just an automated judgment, it's a personal judgment, and looking into those things. And one of the reasons for Deloitte is we're very aware of fraud and the intent to defraud, and so we take that into account, and our teams will be trained to look for that.
Okay, because I know that somebody will try to take advantage of this if possible, so I would urge you to implement as many fraud protection mechanisms as are feasible. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. And also, just to comment on the renewal issue, that is something that has been considered. And we did try to make the renewal process very lightweight. So it's essentially, yes, I want to renew this. Yes, all of this information that you have is still correct, type of thing. But we take the suggestion. Thanks. Okay, next speaker.
I'm David Payne from Afilius. I have two questions. I'll go ahead and ask the first one. It's very related to what we just discussed. And this is prompted by a real scenario. That's basically what it is. You mentioned, a manual back-end process for verifying some of the information. So imagine someone representing to be a licensee of a trademark. It sounds like the trademark owner would be contacted by email in that situation. You also mentioned that a document could be attached with the information. In that scenario, would the licensee need to be required to attach some type of license agreement? And that would be verified, I imagine so. And if so, and like I said, this is prompted by a real scenario, the difficulty of these types of agreements being in multiple different, not just languages, but different scripts. Imagine from, an area of the world where they're using a different alphabet. Do you have the resources to review a document that on the face of it, you actually can't tell if it's related at all to what the information that's been submitted? So that's the first scenario. I just wanted to clarify if the resources are going to be available for that and how that would be handled.
Yeah, from a resource perspective, I don't think there is an issue. We have around 200,000 people in the world, and I think there are not many countries where we're not present. And it is the idea to use our resources globally to help and to obviously find the resources with the right knowledge.
And that's Deloitte's current standing, is that what you mean, the resources?
Yes. Okay. Yes. And if, and we're still working on that, if in certain countries it might be that we feel that we don't have the right resources, then we will make sure that we get them.
Yeah. In necessary, if necessary, that would even include non-Deloitte resources, such as legal resources that, that we could contract with to assist as well.
Okay. And, you know, just to follow up comment on that, I mean, that, that is impressive that you have those kind of resources already, but it's also concerning what kind of costs would be required to implement that thorough of a system. So,
yeah, I don't think, Ali, I'm not going into the cost discussion right now, but no, it shouldn't have an influence on the price as such, I think. That's for us to manage internally. I mean, we all know there are trademarks that we will be able to validate easily, and there are trademarks that will be more difficult to validate, and that's, yeah, that's part of our job. So,
okay. Well, thank you. My second question was about the that a third party is able to dispute information within the clearinghouse. Just more generally, what types of third parties are going to be aware of the information that's in the clearinghouse? How do you imagine that, that happening?
So it would be either third parties that have their information in the clearinghouse, a third party to another trademark holder, or third parties that receive a trademark claims notification.
So another trademark owner that's registered in the clearinghouse would be aware of something that's been registered already? Or do you mean that they may be, they go to register their trademark and they receive information about others that have registered
no.
that trademark?
You never see any information from other third parties, but I can't imagine that some other people will talk to other people saying, oh, they have this trademark in the clearinghouse. Is that correct?
So there's not very much visibility about what information is there in the first place, so how would you be aware of whether you want to dispute it?
So you're right that this is a little bit dependent on, you know, how accessible the, you know, different pieces of the clearinghouse records are. But, you know, the example that Vicky gave is one that you can foresee. So if someone gets a claims notice, meaning a registrant is getting a claims notice, and they see, oh, these people, you know, have these marks in the clearinghouse, you can say, that doesn't look right. I happen to know, you know, this is an error or whatnot. So it's really intended as a mechanism to for people to be able to bring errors to the attention of the clearinghouse. You know, that could be, you know, another rights holder. It could not be. But it's hard to limit or define who that might be. The issue is not so much who's bringing it, but whether the verification of the record was correct.
Okay. That's great clarification. Thank you.
Thanks. Judith?
Yes, good morning. I'm Judith Vasquez. I'm from the Philippines, the third largest English-speaking nation, and the first screen alone challenged the interpretation vis-a-vis Philippine laws on business name registration, trademarks, etc. My suggestion is, on this pilot project, is why don't we launch it in the United States within the context of United States laws? We are so fortunate that the Philippines is not represented at the GAC. But if we had someone seeing, even in English, a disparity in interpretation of a trademark, it can further confuse the issue and slow down what is the new GTLD program. So let's do this one step at a time. I know the Deloitte people in the Philippines. I work with big business. I know your partners is a local external auditor partnered under the Deloitte umbrella. All right? We cannot answer all questions on the floor. Let's be fair. Please, this is a community effort, but we do have to recognize there are national laws involved here. So let's take things a step at a time. So thank you.
Thank you. Werner?
Werner Stahl from CORE. I have two questions. One of them is not actually a question, but rather a proposal. The first one is, if I'm an agent working for other, for trademarks to put in the data, how do I prove to my customer that I've done my job? How does my customer, the trademark owner, see that, you know, I've put the thing in there? If it was a domain name, they would go to the Whois and they could see it immediately. So what do we have in this system that the agent can show that the job has been done, there's some kind of checking, tracking, whatever? What's the mechanism?
That should be determined between the trademark agent and the mark holder. So when a trademark agent comes to the clearinghouse, he will be receiving the notifications on behalf of the trademark holder. How that is communicated to the trademark holder, that is actually up to the trademark agent.
I think it could also change it. The question, Werner, I mean, if you're a registrar, you're operating on behalf of your clients, what would you need to prove to them that you've done your job? Is there any reporting that you need? I mean, we can provide any type of reporting that is required for that, of course. So what would you need if you're a registrar and you want to prove it to your clients?
Actually, is one word, productivity. And that productivity is not just between the agent and the mark holder, it's everywhere. And we've gotten used to a certain amount of productivity thanks to the Whois, with all the bad things that we can say about the Whois. You know, it's actually a rather powerful tool. And here we're trying to do something going back 30 years in time, sending stuff. And did you receive it? You know, it's like this listing. Oh, no, that was not in that listing. It's somewhere else. Oh, no, that's not the latest listing. You have a new one. So this is really a big step backward that I hope to avoid. And it is related to my second question. The second question is about centralization. Why do we centralize the trademark clearinghouse? Actually, if you look at we just kind of started out on the wrong track, and I think there's still time to correct it. And it's also linked to one of the other questions, why do we keep the thing secret that we've done in the trademark clearinghouse? Most of the marks would want the world to know that they have that mark. So at least those who do want the world to know, why shouldn't that be published? It would be 99.9% probably, just those who are just right now in the process of protecting a new mark and don't want to be taken advantage of by speculators, those would, for some time, not want it to be published. But all the other ones would. And we have a wonderful system. It's called the DNS. It has been built for that. It has unlimited capability in terms of scalability and unlimited capability in terms of spreading the workload. Why don't we use it? We still can get it right.
So, Werner, I wonder if I could just sort of confirm the scenario that you're describing in the first comment. So, if I'm a rights holder and I obtain an agent and I hire them essentially to manage all of the trademark records and interactions with the clearinghouse on my behalf, is your question around, is there visibility on the part of the rights holder client to the actual records? Is that the issue that you're raising?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Next speaker.
I'm Susan Crane from Wyndham Worldwide Corporation, one of the world's largest hospitality companies. I know you've indicated we're not going to get into a discussion of costs today, but most major corporations budget months in advance, and we are in the midst of our budget cycle. When are we going to have an idea of what these costs are so that we can work through budgets with our clients?
Hopefully as soon as possible. No, I mean, that we are still faced with a number of variables, and the second thing is that everything is connected to everything. What we've communicated before still stands. That is a maximum of 150, and you can still use that as a basis.
And all the the extra fees for doing other things?
I think a lot is included in that already. But we will, as soon as we can, as we have fixed the variables, then we will come out with the proposed pricing.
Will there be different fees if you do or do not elect Sunrise? Will there be different fees if you do or do not elect Sunrise?
No, because the amount of work that we have to do is exactly the same.
Well, you don't have to verify use.
Yeah, but...
You don't have to generate a Sunrise.
Yeah, but there are... Okay, so... Well, yes and no. The proof of use, the verification of that is not that time-consuming. We also know that there are differences, and I think I've said that before, between certain trademarks where it's easier to verify them than with other ones, for instance, in certain emerging markets. And we decided that we're not going to differentiate in price based on the workload per trademark. I think that's a decision that was taken long ago and that we will want to stick to, because it's going to become very difficult if we have to do that.
Thank you. So.
Christina? Christina Rosette, Covington & Burling. A couple questions, a couple observations. The first being, I wholeheartedly endorse what Paul said about coming up with a way to map, whether you're mapping from commercial databases, docketing databases, docketing software, where the trademark owner has already gotten an entire database of all their trademark data and a way to export that will be hugely time-saving. Second, I would encourage you to think about perhaps an exception to the only one-time free and then you get rejected for errors, particularly as it relates to small businesses or individual trademark owners, and I mean like individuals as opposed to companies, who in many cases will have gone through the entire trademark process by themselves and I think are likely to be somewhat, frankly, more prone to error in the entry. The third thing would be that to the extent that you anticipate requiring documentation from licensees, I would encourage you to A, allow for declarations from the trademark owner, or B, allow for heavily redacted license agreements. I can't think of a single client of mine that would allow its license agreement to be uploaded in the Trademark Clearinghouse. With regard to Werner's point, I do think it's going to be important for a trademark owner to be able to have a report or something of what data has been put in, partly so that they can track what's in there, what still has to go in. As Sunrises go, have I already entered something that's eligible? To the extent that you are going to be doing manual entry, lawyers are going to be wanting to check paralegals and admins. It's just in our genes. So I would really encourage you to think about a way to do that. And finally, and this is the thing that I want to make sure I understood this correctly, with regard to the description of service of goods and services, did I hear correctly that it will be almost kind of a drop-down? And if so, why? You've already got, unless you've got a class heading, you've already got the entire description of goods and services in the registration certificate.
So I'm sorry. You're asking why is it necessary to...
Why would you use a drop-down? If a trademark owner has already developed the description of goods and services and gotten that baked into its registration certificate that's going to be the documentation for whatever it is that they're submitting, mm-hmm. Why would you ask them to basically kind of pick and choose from whatever drop-down categories you've created?
So, the draft or sample trademark claims notice that's in the guidebook does include a field for description of goods or services. So it's intended to, you know, be automatable so that you can put that in. The drop-down that Vicky mentioned also has an other category, am I right?
So let me ask you this. If I'm entering a trademark record and it comes to description goods and services, and let's say that I am in Class 9, which over the history of time has had all kinds of stuff in it, will Deloitte have basically said, okay, we think the 20 most common things in Class 9 are computer software and this, that, and the other, and then we'll have those, you have to pick among them and then drop other? Or am I going to be able to have my trademark registration certificate, if it's manual data, or it's already pre-populated in the database, and that just gets mapped right in? I don't know if I'm being clear or not. I guess what I'm saying is we've already had to develop a description of goods and services that's in our registration certificate. Let us put that in the database as opposed to trying to figure out what abbreviated version you've created works for us.
So to answer that, Christina, the pre-populated format is corresponding to the descriptions that already exist. We're not creating anything new. And the class numbering is next to it, so it's easy to map it. So, for example, if you have a trademark registered in class 9, then you'll see class 9. You just have to select it, and that's it.
Okay.
We're not reinventing anything.
Okay.
Okay, next speaker over here.
Hi, I'm Caroline Perriard. I'm working for Nestle and speaking also in the name of Marks, which is a brand owner association in Europe. I just want to make a comment on the scope of the clearinghouse. So I'm happy to see that, you know, you're working on it, and then there's still a lot to do, a lot of details. And it will be quite a good tool for the brand owners if we really expand the scope of this tool to other services. And you've listed on the, you know, on the list of what it's going to meant for, and you have other services. And I think this is really important. There will be some cost associated. We also expect as brand owners, you know, that the sunrun cost then will come down, because it means, okay, if we do all the work first, then at least you see something. For the trademark claims, that we could also expand it over above the 60 days. So it's really a mean, it's a tool for the brand owners that they can use. And why not also use it as a basis for URS? For example, if you have a URS and you want to say, this is my trademark, you refer to it and it's already there. And it comes back to a question that many had, why not make it public? Because all the data is going to be public. If I am a registrant, I file a trademark, file a domain name, and I get a notification, then I can go and check, okay, this trademark is registered in the name of, and et cetera. So I'm kind of asking you to expand the scope of this tool, so also the brand owners will use it and will think, okay, this is something useful. And, you know, at the end of the day, the consumers will also gain from a clean internet. So thank you.
Thank you. I'll just comment in response to that's something that we have had in mind in terms of how we build this, is that it is something new. You know, we have a defined, you know, set of uses for it that, you know, were agreed upon as part of the new GTLD program. But we're also always mindful of not wanting to build something in a way that would preclude or limit different developments that, you know, could occur in the future. So that's, you know, something that we've anticipated and tried to take into account. Jim?
Yep. Good morning. Jim Prendergast, Galway Strategy Group, and I am not a trademark attorney. Question about the appeals mechanism. You talked about it. It sounded like it was an internal appeals mechanism. Did you consider going to an outside party as part of the appeals mechanism? And if so, why did you not do that as opposed to keeping it within Deloitte or IBM or wherever it is?
So I'll let Deloitte add something if they wish. But, you know, as we've described earlier, we've tried to define the scope of the clearinghouse fairly clearly in terms of having a verification role and a factual, you know, referring to documentation that exists elsewhere type of role, not a, you know, let's make a legal determination on whether these rights are valid or not, or invalid for what purpose, et cetera. So because of that, I think what the quote appeal process really is an opportunity to have a different set of parties review the submission against the same criteria and, you know, see if the result is the same or not.
But did you consider an outside appeals process, or was it always an inside appeals process?
I think we did, yeah. It's you know, partially a cost issue, as well as, you know, is there value in bringing in an independent group to look at the same sort of factual type of inquiry. Okay, John.
Hi, John Berryhill. I had a question about this notion of challenging bad data. And in the hypothetical that was discussed, well, if I'm trying to register a domain name and I get a trademark claims notice back, I could see that you know, information is invalid and go challenge it as one scenario. Although, you know, in that scenario, I can go ahead and register the domain name knowing that, well, that's crap information, but it's not stopping me anyway. I'm curious how that would work in the situation where the Trademark Clearinghouse data is used to procure domains during a sunrise period of a TLD startup. Now, you know, that bad data was used to register this domain, which is now unavailable to me. You know, maybe it's my personal name or something that you know, someone was able to block in the sunrise using a, you know, fraudulent or incorrect trademark claim. How would I be able to go from, okay, here is a sunrise registered domain name, which I don't think was properly registered, to identifying what trademark information in the database was, you know, is to be challenged? Is that clear?
I think so.
Okay.
And it's a good question. Something that we've been trying to ponder because, you know, the issue that is really being challenged is the clearinghouse's action of accepting that record. And you know that action could take place months or years after domain names were registered in the sunrise, right? So it's difficult to retroactively go back and take away domain names or take some action like that
Now that was run when in .info, okay, where the sunrise registered domain names in .info, you know, identify the trademark claim upon which the sunrise domain name registration was premised. I don't know if that's standard across, you know, all of the applications, you know, but at least all of the applications are published, and maybe that's something that should be looked for in the evaluation. Thank you.
Michelle?
Hi. Michelle Jordan reading on behalf of the remote participants. What about words used in commerce in or out of Virginia on an FTP server?
I'm not 100% sure I understand the question, but I'm assuming it's taking an instance of something that somebody would want to put into the clearinghouse as a form of trademark or intellectual property. And I guess I would just refer back to the eligibility requirements that are in the guidebook. There's the three types that Vicky mentioned: nationally or regionally registered, court validated or protected by statute or treaty. There's a fourth category, which is something that, as Vicky described, would be able to be worked out with the registries. If it was a form of intellectual property that a registry wished to work with. So that's the answer to that. And there will be along the implementation of those four types, I think we'll be able to provide some additional guidelines as to how those are taken and considered.
Can I read one more? Is there a bulk entry method to enter multiple trademarks at once in a flat file, etc.?
I think we answered that already. Jan gave an example of how we will create an XML interface and so on.
Wendy Proffitt on behalf of a couple more remote participant questions. This one may be also answered, but similar to the last one, will agents be able to set up multiple accounts so they will be able to turn over a holder's registrations to it in the future if needed without disclosing information of other holders agent represents? For example, it looks like all holders' information will be mixed together in the agent's account.
Can you read that again, Wendy?
Sure. Will agents be able to set up multiple accounts so they will be able to turn over a holder's registrations to it in the future if needed without disclosing information of other holders agent also represents? And the example is, it looks like all holders' information will be mixed together in one agent's account.
We received that question already earlier today, and we're looking into that.
Okay.
On how we're going to deal with that. We got a request to whether that was possible. We hadn't really worked around that yet at this moment, but it's clearly something important, and we're looking into it and see how we can deal with that.
Thank you. I have one more for the remote participant question. Regarding the 90 days to enter a record, will this be rolling depending on the date of the award of the particular GTLD?
So I think this is in regard to the comment that I made earlier about us having a kind of rule of thumb that we want to allow at least 90 days prior to any new GTLDs going live for rights holders to put their information into the clearinghouse. And the question I think goes to, is that a, you know, is that one period or is it, you know, per TLD? It's really one, you know, whatever the first new GTLD is that comes out of the new GTLD process before anybody is going to register names in that. We want to have at least 90 days for rights holders to have put their data in the clearinghouse. Tom?
Hi, Tom Barry from NSERCA. I got a few questions regarding the special characters that get transcribed based on the language of the jurisdiction. What do you do for jurisdictions that have more than one official language? You know, India has like 17, for example. So how would the trademark owner indicate what language to use? Regarding the field for goods and services, I just want to understand how you might use that information, because my understanding is you will, that's a generic description of the international class, and in fact you will store the class against that record. So is it intended for those TLDs that might want to have an additional sunrise according to class? But I think I also heard that you would also use that goods and services within the claims notice itself. And obviously that's a very generic description. It may not reflect the trademark's goods and services itself. So is that understanding clear?
I think so. In terms of the jurisdictions where there are, you know, several official languages, the intention is that, you know, all of them would be available. You know, they may not all be necessarily as important to the rights holder. So if there's, you know, a case where there are, you know, many permutations, they have the election of which ones to incorporate, and then you know, can pay for additional ones. And then on the goods and services field, I think your question goes to, you know, the generic description of the class of goods or services may not tell the recipient of the claims notice in much detail what type of products or services that those rights relate to. And I think the intention, you know, the claims notice needs to, you know, be as much as possible contained within a, you know, reasonable size. So that's kind of the reason that we've allowed the other option to be there too, so that, you know, if a free form description can be provided, you know, so long as it's, you know, not pages and pages, you know, something that would, you know, concisely convey to the trademark or to the notice recipient what the relevant information is.
So if they say other, you don't capture the class, is that right? You don't map it to a class?
So there's the, so right now, correct me if this is wrong, it's either or. You're going to choose the according to the populated classes, or if that doesn't apply, you're going to use the other option.
There's an open comment field, other, where you can actually enter if for some reason you think the classes are not out there.
Okay, Jeff?
Hi, good morning. Jeff Newman. Just first, a real minor comment. I think on one of the charts where you listed the trademarks and the strings, you call the strings a U label, and actually, really technically, that's only used for IDNs. So just if you could make it a little bit more clear. I mean, it makes sense when you convert an IDN to the Unicode version. That's the minor one. And you'll be happy to know I'm not going to come up here and talk about the centralized versus decentralized model. We're working through that. The only thing I will say is that will have an effect on fees. And I know there was a woman who asked about fees before in, as part of the budgeting process. I will say that it's not only the fees that the clearinghouse will charge, but there may be fees that a registry has to charge depending on which type of model is adopted. So, you know, if it's a decentralized model, for example, the registry is doing all of the work, or not all, sorry, a lot of the work. So the registries may have to charge just to make up for those costs. Centralized model, however, may be the other way, that the Trademark Clearinghouse is doing more work, and then the fees may be a balance of that. And with respect to fees, I'm not going to ask you what they are, but what I am going to ask is a question about the model, the fee model. And at the last meeting in Prague, and even at the forum that we had, we the registries had asked, at least with respect to the charge to the registries, to examine the transactional model, meaning a per domain, maybe a small startup fee or setup fee, but a transactional fee as opposed to a flat $10,000 per registry. You know, it's our view that the more you use the clearinghouse as a registry, the more you should pay, the less you use it. So a brand TLD, we made this point the last time, a .Newstar, for example, where our sunrise is not really going to be a sunrise, although we have to do it. We shouldn't necessarily be paying the same price as an open TLD that's got millions of registrations. So, again, I'm not asking you what the price is, but are you coming back to the community with a transactional-based pricing?
The only thing I can say right now is that nothing is off the table.
So I guess then my point to the question to ICANN is that at a point when it is on the table and you do know that, I think that is something that should go out for comment to the community. Even if there are options, you know, there may be an option. It's either this flat fee or this transactional, but that's not something that I'd like to see in a closed room decided for us. That should be something that we as a community should be involved in. Thanks.
Thank you. George?
Thanks. George Sadowski, ICANN Board. You've explicitly mentioned the use, the ability to respond in different languages, but nothing, I think, has been said about different scripts. So could you talk a little bit about the use of extended Latin diacriticals, et cetera, as well as other alphabets such as Arabic, Chinese, et cetera? Are the systems ready for it? Are you going to be able to implement these at the beginning with the Latin? What's the plan?
I can confirm that the system is ready. We can accept any languages, any scripts. And I should have actually put an example out there. My apologies for that, but It is ready.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Claudio.
Thanks, Karen. Claudio DiCandrea, the International Trademark Association. We're a member of the intellectual property constituency. I just had a couple questions. On slide 13, you listed had to do with eligibility. There's a rule in the guidebook that marks in the opposition period are not eligible. I'm not sure if this was inadvertently left off the slide, but I just wanted to confirm that you guys are taking that into account. And I also have a question about the implementation of how that might work. So I just wanted to clarify, because it doesn't seem like that's up on this slide. And that would be in the scenario of somebody went into committed fraud on a trademark office, rushed, you know, got a registration, and then tried to get a sunrise off of it. You know, we've seen the gaming process before. This rule was put in to ensure basically that the mark goes through opposition and the rights are fully rested, essentially. Is that just a mistake that you left it off the slide, essentially?
So that was a question that came up yesterday as well. And I think it probably just was left off the slide. As you alluded to, there's a few, you know, guidelines that need to be developed to take that scenario into account.
Yeah, my follow-up question would be, what does it mean if you're in the opposition period? Let's say the opposition period's 90 days. On day 89, someone files an opposition. Does that mark qualify or not? Because it might take months to resolve the opposition. So it's not really clear when you say within the opposition period exactly what that means. I just think it needs to be fleshed out more clearly, essentially for implementation. And Karen, that goes sort of to a broader point. I think if the actual implementation model was posted for comment, we could probably get the whole community to look at these issues and weigh in a little bit, you know, on a deeper level. In terms of the proof of use, I mean, essentially the role of the clearinghouse, the role that Deloitte's going to be performing is more just data verification. And all these different fields are, you could verify the data on an objective basis. Does the mark match the trademark owner? Does the name of the mark match? Do the registration numbers match, et cetera? It's all objective. You guys are sort of playing a neutral role in that regard. But in terms of proof of use, it seems like there's going to be subjectivity in terms of evaluating the proof of use that's submitted. So my question is, how is that going to work? If somebody submits a specimen of use, are you going to look at it and make a subjective determination if it doesn't look like somebody just puts blog on a pencil, for example, and says, here's my product? How are you going to determine which specimens are valid specimens of use and which are not? And then I have a follow-up question about that.
So it's exactly the same as how do you train people to look at proof of use. So the idea is that there will be a set of questions to which the answer can only be yes or no. And depending on whether it's all yes or whether there's a no in there, it's going to be accepted or not. And I know yesterday during the IPC, people were asking around what are those questions. So I think that is something that we need to come up with so that you can clearly see that it is something that is objective and not subjective.
Right. I mean, there's this Sunrise dispute eligibility procedure built into the guidebook. And what we suggested in our public comments is that the challenge should operate through at the registry level. So if someone has a dispute, we don't want the clearinghouse being a trademark office in making these determinations. And it could actually happen at the registry level if you build the right rules. It would require updating the Sunrise eligibility rule in the guidebook, though, to do that. A question about the matching rules. The implementation documents spell out that special characters, and it lists the M sign and the ampersand sign. Is there any reason why it's just being limited to these characters, not the plus sign, for example? Because there's a lot of trademarks that have plus sign. You could easily, you know, spell out plus, for example.
Yes, that's agreed. The language in the guidebook does provide special treatment for those two characters specifically. That was based on the guidance of the STI group, and in the recommendations, the word "only" is actually used there. So only these special characters get this translation rule applied to them, the ampersand and the at, and that's why in this implementation it focuses on those.
Because I looked at the STI report and they just list those in a parenthetical. I think the clause, I don't understand why only those characters would be singled out. I don't understand the distinction between those characters and other special characters. It seems like they were just listed as an example. Even if it's based on the STI recommendation, I don't understand the underlying logic behind why those characters are different than other characters.
And I guess I would have to go back to the discussions that took place, but my understanding is that there was a discussion of how broadly or how narrowly to tailor what would constitute an identical match. And, you know, my understanding of the result was that those two characters it was limited, that treatment was limited to those from a group that of characters that I think had originally been larger.
It just seems inconsistent with trademark law. You'd be essentially excluding validly registered trademarks for inclusion in the clearinghouse just because they had these other characters in there.
They're not excluded from registration in the clearinghouse. It's just that the matching rules don't apply to those matching domain names automatically.
Right. Okay. And then also, my last question is in terms of the eligibility rules. The first one says word marks are eligible, and then the fourth clause are other marks that constitute intellectual property. So this can include, like, our interpretation of four is basically, when trademark owners have adopted logos which have incorporated their wordmarks and have only registered the composite mark consisting of a text plus a design. So we're talking about stylized letters or text plus design. Those are other marks that constitute intellectual property. Just to be clear, I'm not talking about textual descriptions of design marks, but just marks that might have stylized letters. It seems like four is sort of the catch-all to get those in there. And is that consistent with your interpretation, Karen?
Thank you. Yeah, so as I mentioned, I think we'll be able to provide some more guidelines around those four categories that are listed in the guidebook. In regard to the other marks category, further down in a corresponding section of the guidebook, it describes those as something that would be arrived at by an agreement with the registry that had proposed specific type of mark or intellectual property that they wanted to protect.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we're actually already past time, so if you can, we'll finish the queue that exists, but if you can limit the remarks if you can. Thanks. Michelle?
Okay, I'll just ask one more. Michelle Jordan reading for the remote participants. Regarding annual renewal, if the mark has only 6 months left on its national registration, will it change to invalid on the date of expiration unless a new renewal record is entered during that 6 months? How far in advance of expiration must the record be submitted? Regarding U.S. records, how will you deal with the marks that are in the grace period?
So in principle, when your trademark expires within a period of the 12 months, you actually have the obligation to keep your trademark record at all times accurate, so you will be able to provide us with the trademark renewal fees. And as for the second question as to when... And for U.S. trademark, there's no expiration date, but there's always a registration date or application date, and depending on the corresponding national law, there's the term is fixed from the application date or registration date, so it will be possible to complete the expiration date.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mark?
Mark Trachtenberg with Winston & Strawn, a member of the IPC. I think I understood you to say that there'll be at least a 90-day notice period before the first delegation of any TLD, but not a similar notice period for subsequent delegations. Was that correct, as far as being able to having notice to enter marks into the clearinghouse?
So certainly, I think there will be, advance notice of any time there is a new Sunrise. I think that the clearinghouse is tracking that information, and then the registries will, of course, be publicizing and making that information available. But what I meant to suggest was, in terms of operational capabilities for the clearinghouse, that in a global sense, before any of the new GTLDs are beginning registrations, we want to have at least 90 days for rights holders to put data in.
And I think I would just point out that there should be built into the system some sort of similar notice period, whether it's 30, 60, or 90 days for each subsequent delegation, because otherwise the burden's on the trademark owner to enter their entire portfolio into the clearinghouse in the very first 90-day period, because we're not going to know which TLDs are ultimately going to delegate or what the requirements are going to be. And so if you have a country like China, where you have to register in each of the different classes, all of a sudden this becomes enormously expensive for trademark owners. So I think it's critical that the process include, some sort of reasonable advance notice. Again, 30, 60, 90 days, whatever it is, just something built into the system.
Thank you. So your request is that there would be some sort of automatic tracking notice anytime there's a new GTLD going online?
Exactly, because we're not going to know. I mean, you guys are going to know, so it's easier for you to post notice. And, what method of notice you use, I would, suggest the ICANN website and various other outlets, that can be figured out later, but at least some sort of, reasonable notice to the public and the trademark owners so that we have time to decide whether we want to put, the relevant marks into the clearinghouse.
Thank you. All right, and last speaker.
Jean-Paul Béchu, CEO of NameShield. We've got in our system databases of trademarks. We've got a few millions of them, and we have noticed that there's a lack of consistency in the way trademarks owners register their trademarks, and sometimes there is a small difference. One of the company that asked you a question, I looked in the database, and I found out four different ways they did register their trademarks. Sometimes it's a small difference. There is a lack of a word. It's still the same company. How are you going to deal with those?
Well, if it would be purely automative, in an automative way, that's sometimes difficult to match. But in this case, it's people who will do the matching.
Okay.
And they should be able to make the difference or to see to which extent the two records are the same, which is not different from how we've done this in the past, so during sunrises.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for your attention. Thanks to the team up here for presenting and answering the questions. We look forward to hearing from you again. And the next session in this room is the Who Is update at 11. Thank you.